out. Going the right way?
Yeah, now it's going.
All right, we're in business.
Well, it's probably a favor.
Yeah, I need to adjust this.
Was it made on that Wolf machine you have there?
That was, I think it was dated 1899. It came from Ainsford Mill at, in Kent, I think.
The old machine?
Yeah, I don't know if it was out of Ainsford Mill.
Yeah, they made the Arnold paper.
Yes, their brochure. I don't think they're interested in that at all.
Yeah. We got one of these, Jillian, who we're staying with, she had one.
She had an Arnold brochure,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, she let us have. This is beautiful. Yeah,
I saw Cyril had one of those, too. Mm-hmm. Those Arnold brochures.
That's, you must have got a number of these when you took over the mill or something.
Well,
that
I was done with them, but, you know, you just...
Right, just toss them out.
That's what I don't know. Anybody wanted one, had one of them?
Repulp the rest?
What?
Repulp the rest?
Yeah.
I think this, the other one was tied with string instead of being spiral bound with the bell. It was tied with a gold thread. Oh, I don't know.
Or more limited edition.
It's the same thing.
Those papers in the book are going to give you welcome to them.
They're wonderful. Get this thing up here so we make sure we're getting all the noise we want. Will this make you shy or anything?
Yeah.
Me neither. Here, let me see now. I
have somewhat of a retired major. I was a sergeant major in the Army.
Oh, well, then you'll have no problem.
Show you a bit.
Did you ever know Harry Glanville?
Only... To recognize him,
yeah.
But, you know, I don't think I spoke to him
more than
once or twice.
When Cyril, me and Jillian went and interviewed him a couple of years ago. He's 92, and he told some good stories, and we made a little book of his stories. And this is what we're hoping to do about the Tuckenhay Mill, is make a book full of reminiscences of the paper makers and the men who worked at the mills and historical information.
Yeah. What can we think of as a story? That's not a fairy story.
No. But I was interested to hear that you refitted the beaters and things. Did they need constant repair, or did they work on their own pretty well?
They reboard at least once every 12 months. Sometimes 6 months they needed doing it. Refit the bars. You're familiar with that?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
I build a Hollander beater. We make paper by hand.
And you've got a Hollander.
That I built myself, yeah. It's a solid bronze, though. It doesn't have the bars fitted in.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Well, those are cast iron drum with slots.
Mm-hmm.
And the bars were put in and wedged in with wooden wedges.
Yeah.
You know, 4 foot wedges. It's a long and tedious job. Quite a bit of skill about it, really, because the wedges had to be planed to fit pretty well. And because we had Hollanders. There were three types of Hollanders.
Yeah.
The breaker.
Yeah.
The washer.
Yeah.
And the beater.
Right.
The breaker had a garter ring in to hold the bronze bars in.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the drum slots.
Yeah.
Then there's a annular ring slot in it right around.
Right on the outside.
The ring goes in into the nibs in the bars to hold it in. But they're basically out in the wedges, because as soon as the wedges go, the bars start rattling, and that's it. You're going to rebar it again. You know?
Yeah.
But to
rebar, did the bars fall out, and you have to replace and put new bars in, or did you just have to make them sturdy again?
If they were damaged, you'd have to put in new ones, which caused a bit of difficulty, because then you had to trim them to get them down to the same length as the others. They had to trim them anyway when you put them. We had you imagine a screw thread with the tool holder of a lathe on a long double bar, This was clamped on the beater bed.
Mm.
And you run it along, run the beater and run it along and trim the tips of the bars till you got them all.
Kind of like a lathe turning down.
Well, yes, yeah, so you put a lathe tool in or a lathe cutting tool.
Oh, really? So that's how you ground them to round?
Yeah, you chip them off. You used to do it years ago, apparently by hand, right? You know,
with a
Markham and a coaches.
Oh, you know, cool.
I mean, you've never done it really accurately. Anyway, I've done them a couple of times when I first went there because he didn't have this trimmer.
You did it with a cold chisel.
Yeah. I mean, really speaking, the beaters then isn't really efficient until it's done about two lots and bedded itself.
Ground itself
in,
huh?
It's really done it.
Did it matter if it was perfect?
Well, it's really speed of operation. You know, it made a difference of 6 hours to beat a length down, and if it was a good, the beater's in good neck, it perhaps did it 4.
Which
again
really
depended on the rag you had, you know, different rags, different times.
Right.
Because well, Sam Cox would have been a boy for that, but he died a couple of years back.
It's a shame we didn't come a couple of years ago, huh? He knew a lot about beaters.
Yes, well, he worked in for years. And he was in the timing and all that sort of thing, you know, and the beater roll, well, I suppose it was the same, lifts up and down, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the bed plate was a bronze plate,
mm-hmm.
serrated bronze plate, and of course they lifted up while they were filling the machine, and then once it stuff started rotating properly, they gradually lowered the roll down on it until they got the length as required. But it was usually 3 or 4 hours at least. I've never heard nothing much to do with the time of the job. Yeah.
Did you ever work as a papermaker at all, or did you work only as a fitter?
Well, the only thing I ever did as a papermaker was to go and make a few sheets when I went on the invert to see if you could do it.
Could you?
Yeah.
All right.
Actually, there's a lot of skullduggery about papermaking. They used to say that chap had to do 3 years apprenticeship before he could do it. When you, all things went, when you come down to hard facts, the chap was there and was really interested in doing it in a matter of a few weeks.
Yeah, they just sort of forced him into the long run.
That's right, yeah. The, well, I mean, you've seen, the, well, there's a picture on there of the bloke doing it, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
Yes. The,
Hello?
Hello?
My wife is
looking. Let me stop this for a
morning.
Moment. Yeah, it's causing us no trouble now. We're in business here.
Upset the most people. What are we talking about?
Oh, you're saying how easy it is to make paper.
Well, I don't know. That's what I thought. Anyway, you know, different opinions. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, we used to, the old, when I first started working in the mill, the only maintenance people there was a carpenter and one fitter. That was myself and the carpenter. And he's an old chap who'd been there all his life, like, you know, there's got a lot of stories out there about the mill. But, we used to, the running gear on the vats, you know, the, I don't know what you name it as we did, the...
The hog?
Hog, yeah. The hog, I should say the agitator with the hog, and then there's the knotter.
Yeah.
And the slice, and the chest.
Yeah.
The agitator and the chest. And all these things, anything that wanted to do, we used to do when they finished at the end of the week, like, you know, the last couple of days. They used to work, piecework, you know, so many posts of paper was a week's work.
Right.
Or a day's work. And they, when they'd done their week's work, they used to pack up, they used to finish about Thursday.
Really?
Yeah.
They could do it, huh?
Yeah. And, well, and they used to start very early in the morning. You know, they used to start about 4 o'clock in the morning, and you know, go until 4 in the afternoon before they packed up. Usual sort of day. It seemed a bit crazy to me. But anyway, that
why did they work? Did they want to have the Friday off, and what would they do?
I suppose that's the idea. You know.
What were they doing?
Sleep mostly.
Yeah, because they're so tired, aren't they? I think so.
But the, as I when we used to, you know, overhaul the, I mean, all the bearings and that in the hog itself was on bronze bearings,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, anti-rust and the, all the running gear around it was all wooden bearings that's running in water, you know. And these bearings wanted replacing very regular intervals. I mean, there's no way you could lubricate them. They're water lubricated.
So you used wooden bearings. What kind of sort of wood did you use?
Oh, it's all beech.
Yeah?
You know, nearly everything. The wedges and the beaters. And the bearings, because it's all beech. It doesn't make a stain, you know. I mean, oak goes blues, you know.
Mm.
Different things like that. But beech doesn't. And we do these and then run it to see if it was all right, like, and because the beaters used to run longer hours than the vat house because it took longer to beat the pulp down and
yeah.
get it in, and that did them to shake it together. Of course, we used to pull our legs, say, you know, the paper maker doesn't make a paper, he only shakes it together, it's made in the beater.
I like that he only shakes it together.
We always used to call them water sifters.
Water sifters?
Yeah.
That's what you call the Batman?
Sifting water.
Do you have a name for the Coochers?
Well, their right name was Catcher, really, wasn't it?
Catcher?
Well,
because they caught the felt?
Well, that's what they were chatting. Showed the mole along the bridge, and the Coocher caught it. I mean,
yeah.
I think, I'm sure that's where he got his name from.
From Catcher.
Catcher. Because a lot of their names are terribly mutilated, weren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, they used to call the half sheet, which was... Demi, isn't it?
Yeah.
They used to call it Demi. And then they went to such an extent, they got double Demi. Double half. I mean, it's in Irish, isn't it?
They should have called it a hole again, huh?
Used to pull her like that. And the Ronald used to be a great guy. Used to pull his leg quite a bit. Ronald Eaton.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things that tickled me at no end was that they we had a system eventually where they had to put a card in when the machinery broke down, you see.
Uh-huh.
They used to send for a fitter, and they used to claim standing still time when the machinery broke down. And they made such a thing of it that in the end they had to clock out when their machinery broke down, and you ever put them running, clock them in again, you know. And they had to write on their card what was wrong, like.
Uh-huh.
And Ronald, you know, actually deco broke, you know, that's a breakdown for bringing all them up. Writes deco, D-K-K-O. Said
yeah.
He knows so much about his training, and he even had to spell the name of the thing. Deco.
Yeah, he talked a lot about having to do things like cutting the weeds because the equipment was broke or there wasn't rags.
Yeah. Yes, there were some doctors like that. But they really worked themselves out of the job and all there. Because the mill finally was only making paper pulp, you know,
yeah.
for other factories, because the handmade paper businesses, it was costing too much to make and sell for it wasn't so good, and you know, it just went out, like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they would...
Milk,
no sugar, please, yeah.
Would you like milk?
They,
yeah, no sugar.
I won't tell you. You're gonna.
She probably knows that by now, huh?
Just a minute. They used to put so much of this standstill time in, like that. I mean, it got beyond all sense. I mean, I could never see how a person working a week's work could knock off on Thursday and have half a day standing still time. Or thing, you know.
The piece work thing was set pretty.
Well, yeah.
It was set higher than it should have been, maybe.
Always was, yeah. And they used to, you know, work all sorts of wangles. When you make the paper, you know, you've. I mean, I don't know, would you use the same procedure? They used to.
I think so, yeah. Go ahead.
Dips.
Yeah.
Put it on the bridge.
Yeah.
Threw it to the catcher.
Right.
And cut the deco.
Right.
Took the other mold and dipped again, and
right.
this sort of went round and round. And the coocher took the mold and rolled it on the felt to take the trim off, and put it back up on the bridge, and put another felt on top. And the layer
mm-hmm.
was laying the paper off the other pack, the one that had gone before, and putting the felts back on the bridge. Then.
Mm-hmm.
So they used to have, we'll say for an argument, I mean, all these papers had different numbers of felt, didn't they? Postals had different number of
right.
every size. We'll say it's 100.
All right.
And they have 120 felons. So when they made up their 100, all the packs pressing, all the packs
right.
in and pressing,
they're making
they
their
use their tail felts, as they call them. Which was the,
those extra 20?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They went on that.
Use their tail
felts. The time they'd use them, the pack was out and the layer was thrown back the others and it went on without interruption. Well, they would put the whole 120 on the pack, or perhaps leave one or two, show the pack in the press, and then they would press is slow, went on, claim a 2 minutes standing still.
I mean, cheating, huh?
It was really, well, I always told them, it was telling their face as infantile.
Yeah.
I don't know why they did it. I mean, they're killing their own trade, you know, because it went to such an extent that it finally made them use the clock.
So that's why Harrison got so mad, because it seemed like they were sort of cheating.
Harrison is a bloke I haven't known him for years. I never really understood him, because he used to say, well, look, you know, these blokes are pulling it, you know, do something about it. And he wouldn't believe that they would cheat him.
What's pulling it mean?
Well, cheating.
Oh, you'd say that too?
Yeah, he'd say, oh, my men wouldn't cheat me. They wouldn't swindle me for anything. They were doing it all the time. Like, it was the same with the people he dealt with, you know, the dealer. I mean, pulp business, he lost that through practically the same attitude. I mean, he was buying rags from agents who were taking the paper pulp and selling, doing the end, and all they did was made it and load it and all sort of thing, which sounds all right. But the truth of the matter is, paying a tremendously high price for his rag and getting a fairly low price for his pulp.
That's what Cyril said that too, yeah.
When a chap came...
Can I offer you whole neighbours,
very generous.
No, you don't get rid of
thank you. We had a Spaniard come there. Funny, I mean, it's called Miguel, nearly.
Is that who Kitty said, the Italians, or is that different?
What?
Kitty was saying the Italians were working there at the end.
Oh, yeah, no, this was a...
Different.
This was a chap who came from Spain, a paper maker, who was making paper in Spain, in Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
And he was using pulp from paper mills, from Tuckany Mills, part of it. Makeup, I don't know what
that's
it was all.
Don't
he was
more.
Buying this from Bunzel and Biak, who were the agents.
Yeah.
We were taking the Tuckany Mill. And he was paying, I don't know the exact price, but around about £300 a ton for it.
Mm-hmm.
The mill was getting 200. And, okay, Bunzel and Biak got to get something out of it, but you know, it seemed a bit of an idea.
Price, huh?
But they, when Miguel came, he was in this country for some reason or other, and he came to Tuckney Mill to see where, you know, an interest and see where his pulp come was like. And he proposed to Mr. Harrison, like, you know, and he was present when he left it. But instead of going through Bunzel and Biak, we sent it direct. It was actually the China Clay people that, down near Plymouth, you know, they send a lot of books. They go across to the continent, and partly by sea and partly by canals, they go right down to Barcelona. You know, they were sending clay down there.
Mm-hmm.
And their cargoes are, you know, very heavy and small in bulk. So they always look for lighter deck cargoes.
All
you know,
right.
To, you know, make a bit. And
Jack, be good.
Be good. They would take this paper pulp right down to Barcelona and sort of half of what it was costing them to go the other way.
To ship it around, yeah.
And Miguel wanted to deal direct, and he offered Harrison, I mean, sticking to our 100, 200, somewhere around about 275 instead of 200 a ton for it. And he said, well, bypass my agent, not business ethics, what have nothing to do with it.
Interesting.
Which, and then when the mill closed, we had 60 tons of rag that had come from Bunzel and Bear at £120 a ton. This was a specially good sort, and he said, well, we'll sell that back to them, they'll take that back because they're rag dealers, they were, you know, and they couldn't give them more than £10 a ton for it. And then there was some argument about transport, and so he burned it rather than let them have it.
Yeah, he was mad.
Oh, absolutely. I saw him the other day, and the first words he said to me was, "Nothing about Tuckney Mill. I don't want to hear anything."
Well, that's interesting, yeah. How long ago did you talk to him? I mean,
oh, only about a couple of minutes, actually.
Well, no, because I called him up about a month ago.
Oh, this was about a week ago.
Yes, so it must have been between when I talked to him.
Probably what stirred his memory of it, because he hates Tuckney Mill.
Yeah, yeah, well, I had to talk to him because I had this letter from him that talks about the history of the mill.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him if I could have permission to publish it, because I'm planning on doing a book about the mill. And he gave me permission, but he said, "Don't mention my name. I don't want anybody talking to me about it." He said, "That's the only thing you'll have to promise, is not to say my name or my whereabouts." But he didn't really mind. He straightened up all the facts as he could see from the letter if anything he thought was wrong. So I think he said he really loved the mill. That was his problem, that he stayed there because he loved the place. He fell in love with it. But I think he thought it was a mistake.
It's a queer way of showing it. I mean, he insists on in the batters when they're making the paper, the presses were on. I don't like presses.
Mm-hmm.
One here, old ones, 1890s to the date, I think. But in the mill and the other buildings that weren't used, there was still the old screw presses, you know, that they used back in
yeah, I know what you mean.
See, Seckham was the only person I know of that was there, and he was about 4 Turner and Turner Simmons and all these people. Turner's supposed to be the painter, but I don't think the dates don't line up. I think somebody's
different Turner, huh?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't think it's. He was a painter, right? He painted because there was a letter there. That was the thing.
Did you get any of these bits of letters and things?
No, I should have kept this one. I give it to Mr. Harrison. I thought he'd be interested in it. And he immediately tore it off, this particular one.
Oh, no.
But it was. Actually, it was a copy of a letter, to be quite honest, but done at the time, you know, a foil copy.
Yeah.
He said that, basically, you know, I don't get the exact words, but the, when Mr. Simmons left the mill, he had a number of paintings that had been done by Mr. Turner for him of Tuckney Mill and the river and Sharp on the state, which is down the river, which belonged to Simmons in those days. Which he said he wouldn't part for £1,000, and this was in italics, and a lot of money in those days. And the question was how to get them away, because they were comparatively large oil paintings and framed. But he got a local haulier, which I should know, I don't remember the name of, but I don't remember.
Probably Ford, Kitty probably had that one, the old
backpack.
Yeah, this is the one
too.
Yeah.
He
said
we
you Tuckney Mill had a
hold on.
She was
okay.
Yeah, her dad came down to the mill when Arthur Milgram bought it as a paper maker. Uh-huh. He was a big man. And his son Sam and his brother took on after this. We dad in the mill, yes.
So you're related to the Coxes?
To Kitty. Yeah.
We met Kitty, we visited her.
That's Grandfather Cox came down from Ainsford, Kent. So,
when he had the fire, or did you get to stay away?
I was there. Actually, basically, taking the machinery out, you know, from the because it was all smashed up, you know, went for scrap, everything, the beaters, the big dryer and one of the washing machines went to Austria somewhere. But of course, the paper machine had been broken up years before. That was funny that because. When Simmons rebuilt the mill, he put a paper machine in.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the first paper machines in the country. And it was, I've only seen the blueprint of the base of the machine. Not, the machine was gone, it was taken out in 1900, 1902. So when Milburn took over, anyway, they took, the first thing they did was broke this machine up, threw it out, you know. Handmade paper was a thing, you mustn't have machines, you know.
Hmm.
And they, but that was an Escher voice, which was also made in Zurich. But it was a queer machine. As I say, the blueprint was only, that I saw, was only the base, you know, the concrete base to put it in, and there was only a shadow of the machine sort of roughly sketched in. And also the description from the old carpenter, whose father was the engineer at the mill when it was rebuilt.
Yeah.
And this machine, apparently the paper came out both ends of it. Came out two ways. And Purse, the carpenter, said it was made on a mold shaken the same as a hand mold is. And
must have been an odd machine, huh?
Yeah, well then, after the paper was made, taken out, it was pressed afterwards.
So it was done by hand? So
it was hydraulic presses there, and it was all set up, these things. And I'd say the details, and there was lots of bits of it laid about at the mill still, and we were like, you know, cast iron pillars that we used for other jobs, and there were some wheels and ratchets and that, but I was always wanted to find out how it worked exactly. Apparently there was a steam engine built into it, and there was a cone drive, which must have been, I mean, with a paper machine, you've got to run your felt and your rolls at different speeds,
right,
to suit how the paper stretch it. And,
right.
And I suppose the cone drive was the difference between the two, because if you had a steam engine here, you wouldn't want to, you could run it at what speed you wanted, it'd be independent of any other,
right,
thing, so the cone drive would be redundant. But apparently, you know, the double cone drive, I mean, what's the name talks about, I mean, incidentally, I've got a couple of books here, handmade paper. Emerson on engineering.
Hmm.
I don't know what the date of it is, because it's not dated, but it must be, because his up-to-date machine is, what's it called? My flipping head, I forget the name or anything. You know, the bloke that made the first steam engine. His name.
Oh, no, I don't know his name, but I'm not sure. You know, what was the end of that story that when your wife came in, you were saying about how I got the Turner pictures out? I want to make sure I get the end of that.
He got a local haulier,
mm-hmm,
was hired to take, this is how it was worded, like, I can't give you an exact word, but to take the pictures from the mill to the railway station here.
Yeah.
And I say, I want to know the name of the haulier, because it doesn't matter a lot. But so when the carpenter made the crate, boxed the pictures up, and when the haulier man came with the horses and wagon to collect the pictures, he was given the money to go by the toll road. But they didn't go by the toll road, or him and his mate didn't, they kept the money for beer, and they went by the old road, and they had an accident and tipped the wagon over, and the papers were done, some of the pictures were damaged.
Hmm.
And you know, that's pretty well all that's it. That's, but the thing that interests me in it, and I probably wouldn't interest you at all,
no,
which was the old road and which was the toll road from Ashbrook or from Tuckeney to, when there are pillars, at Bowden Pillars, which is part way up there, which is obviously a gate of some sort, which was probably the toll road, and there's another road would come over Thomas Downhill, which is pretty steep. In those days, it would have been narrow, I suppose.
Oh.
Jack, everybody doesn't want you on their lap. He thinks everybody's here to pay you. But, I mean, it's not much of a story, but it was all written out, and of course, I gave it to Harrison and said, you know, look at this, this is interesting. He said, my God, there's a signature on it. Somebody might counterfeit it. He did the same when it was...
he was really paranoid.
Another letter about... water rights, and how they got an agreement.
Yeah, Mr. Wheeler.
There was a letter written just after the 1418 War,
you know,
by Milburn to the local builder who built those houses, you know, that straight down the mill.
The terrace ones, yeah.
Yeah. And they were built, I see there's 8 houses there. Mm-hmm. Is it 8 or 10 there? I don't know, my memories are.
There was 10.
That's right, yeah. The 8 of these houses were built before the 1418 war.
Oh, yeah.
And the other 2 were built after.
Never really.
And this letter said that they had difficulty in facing up to the fact the original houses cost £90 each to build. And now they require 120 for the last 2. And if one of them sold just recently for £80,000.
I know, it's awful, isn't it? That's amazing.
But Harrison had destroyed it, you know. Is it a signature? Somebody may counter it. Of course, he's a lawyer by trade, and I think they're all mad, every town. Never met a lawyer yet, I think.
That's what we saw one from Ron. This clock at per se, worst thing, that it didn't come from the arch,
It came from St. Mary's Church.
And where's
that's
that?
The church right next to the arch.
Oh.
But I argue with this, because their argument is that if it came from the arch, it was made by Stumbles. And Stumbles wouldn't use cast iron in any of his clocks. It's one of these, you know, systems. He said that cast iron warped after a while and made the clocks inaccurate. So he would not use cast iron in any form in his clocks, any of the works of his clocks. And they say the clock out there, the corner members, are cast iron.
Uh-huh.
And therefore,
it's, oh, wouldn't have been his clock.
Therefore, it's Brockhurst. And now I've got 2 arguments against this thing. One, the corner things are not cast iron. They're wrought iron. I've taken the clock right down to the last piece. And why they say it's cast iron is because the top of them have got highly ornamented cast acorns on it. But when you take it down, those unscrew and they're cast, okay. But the pillars themselves are wrought iron.
Yeah, so probably they're wrong.
Now, another thing is, St. Mary's Church.
I finished quarter 6 in the evening, but that was, 54-hour week, you know, and that was about 12 and sixpence, 12 shillings.
You've got to break down, I suppose that's 63 pence.
So 63 pence compared to the paper maker who got £2.40 and the farm labourer who got £1.
That's right, that's
£1.50.
Yeah. But we all did long hours.
You worked in the rag room? Is that right?
No, I was in the drying room, and then I went to the side department.
In the drying room, did you stick paper up in the loft, or were you
running the
machine?
Through the machine, and then through the side house. It was the waterleaf paper went in dry.
Right.
Through the size machine. I don't know how you size.
Well, internally.
Oh, you do it all?
Yeah. In the vat.
Yeah,
I mean in the machine.
Peter. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but this was all done. Waterleaf paper was fed into the machine and it went through at a certain heat. I don't know what it was. He probably tell us what heat. Yeah. And then it was paper
Fahrenheit.
Wet.
Yeah.
And then it went up to be hung in the loft.
Yeah, I don't know if the system there was different than anywhere else, but basically it was starting at the beginning, the right cable rung was sorted, cut, then boiled, and then it went in the breakers, broken down, and it went down in the bleach tanks and was bleached. I mean, all rags didn't go exactly the same, it depended on what their colour was and what their
right
was. But it would basically, they go down to be bleach, stay so long in bleach, then it brought back to the beater room and put in the washer, where it was beaten and washed at the same time until the bleach was neutralized. and then it went into the beater, it was beaten, and it went down into the holding tanks, one for each vat, went into vats, made into paper, and pressed. Now it was dry, it was taken up and put in a press, and left for so long under pressure, after made, like in the block. And then it was split off, and dried in a drying machine over a cylinder dryer.
Mm.
And there was a single cylinder dryer and a four cylinder dryer I used to go with. And after being dried there, it used to stand for something.
Two sheets at a time through the dryer, not a single sheet, two sheets.
Depends on the thick.
Well, the very thick stuff on single sheet. But
and banks, would they go through three, or would they, would banks and really thin sorts go through three?
Only two.
And then they, after being dried on the cylinder dryer, it stood for so long, and then it was sized.
How long? Weeks, days, months? You know?
Some of it was months. Yeah. It depends again on what it was. I mean, really speaking, the real reason that we found this out was, we did a little bit of scientific work on it, you know. I worked hand in glove with Harrison on that, and we lowered that down quite a bit. The fact that what they used to do was over-dry it.
Huh.
And then you had to wait for it to come back before it would...
they'd over-dry it in the cylinder machine, so they had to get,
rehumidified.
Yeah,
that's right,
yes. We put finer controls on the thing, you know, steam traps and temperature gauges and pressure loaders on the... You could dry it much quicker and not so far down, and it would size in. And the same used to apply with their loft drying. After it was sized, then it was loft drying and hung. But they invariably over dried that. They used to have to stand something for months before it was reduced down, before you could put it.
Before it gets flat?
You could glaze it or anything.
How come it had to wait so long? Because it would be so cockly?
It was.
Yeah.
To wait for the cylinder. Even if it was being, I mean, some of it was glazed, you go through glazing rollers, but even then it had to be a certain softness, so the glazing roller would leave it patchy, you know. With that we found too that, actually the latter part of the mill, we had a drying machine made by Listers of Dursley. This was a machine where there's trays that went through a hot chamber.
Oh, we've heard about that.
This was controllable, and actually some funny things were that. I don't know if it's any interest to you, but when we first put it in, the old paper makers, including the manager, old Sam Hastings, said, "It won't work, it's useless, it absolutely not."
But Harrison wanted to buy it, is that what it was?
He'd already bought it then, like, sorry, we go. And he said, "It won't let it. Everything would be useless, the paper would be spoiled, you know." Anyway, the first thing in it was the troubles with the handmade paper job used to be that the drying was a bottleneck. They had to run their lofts 24 hours a day, often as not 7 days a week, to dry what was made. And, you know, it's always useful to...
That's true for me too.
Mm-hmm.
But the, this dryer, first day we started going, you know, with all these trays going around, I put the paper in, they dried all day's making in half a day, like, you know.
Everybody was amazed,
huh? Oh, and then the customers, Sam Hastings and one of the old ones saying, "Oh, the paper will be no good, it'll be..." And it wasn't so cockily as their loft dried stuff, you know, and I thought, "Oh, there's some..." Anyway, it wasn't so, it dried 3 days that something you could see joy in his eyes, he'd found something, you know, he said, "It's no good, I've found out what's wrong with it, I knew there'd be something wrong with it." And this was the hydraulic test of the paper, was right down, you know, the, do you use a hydraulic test?
No,
well, this was a, like a little machine with a diaphragm, rubber diaphragm.
Oh, okay, I know
that. Circle comes down on that, and you put a sheet
burst
of paper.
Strength, right.
Yeah, bursting strength. You wind it up, watch the pressure go up, and when it pops, that's it, really. And the paper that had been through the Lister dryer was only half the strength of the paper that had been dry, loft dried, and been through. Interesting. This is a trouble. This is a trouble. It's useless.
But it doesn't make any difference once you gel it inside it. It's got so much strength anyway.
What?
I mean, it would be so strong anyway once you gel it inside it, yeah?
That was sized paper, oh. Finished paper. And, this is... I said, well, hang on, there must be an answer to this, what is it, And of course, actually, I take credit for finding out what's wrong with it, because I rumbled right away. In the size machines, you'd be very careful not to bring the size above 120 degrees, or you spoil the size.
Right.
It got hot, and it tend to crystallize, really. I mean, you'd need a microscope to see it, but, this was the theory, I think.
Right.
That the size that had been too hot would be... would crack.
Yeah.
Of course, in this blister dryer, you're drying it at 200 degrees.
it's cracking
the size. So we
turned the temperature
down to 120. Now, it took nearly twice as long to dry it, but it's still easily handled in the whole mill making the time. And the hydraulic test of the machine paper and the other was identical. we got over that one. But, we've had some fun, there are different things.
Then, of course, certain papers were glazed with a hot plate, weren't they? Yeah. You've forgotten that. Metal.
Steel plates.
Plates were fed. I see the paper.
Fedding.
This is how it was glazed anyway. Through the rolls.
Right.
Between
two plates.
Yeah. This was put in the plates, and then the body metal plates, it was flat of steel.
Zinc, right?
Through the rollers.
Okay.
The rollers are made of a book, a scale plate, a sheet of paper.
Yeah.
So many sheets, depending again what's in that, how high the glaze
and right.
Stuff. But the hot press, they had a big oven. They used to put these steel plates in.
Great big iron.
You needed it, little job down there. They used to put them in and get them right up to inject steam or get them up to temperature. And they used to be put in the, there was a hydraulic press there. It's going to be a press off the old paper machine. They used to put a steel plate and so many sheets of paper, sometimes with zincs as well and sometimes without. Mind of the paper mill,
yeah,
and they build up and then put under pressure, tons of the square inch, which on those presses were 90 tons, and kept there for 24 hours.
Until the plate cooled down.
Well, it all cooled down.
And that was hot pressing, and the glaze on that was sort of, special.
Really shiny.
Yeah.
Incidentally,
yeah.
You'll see a paper marked NOT.
Yeah.
That's incidentally. Don't laugh too much about it. Not hot plate pressed. OT and NOT.
All right.
But the NOT was not hot pressed. You only left the H. Again, this is papermaker spelling.
Right.
I think they get Kucher and Demoy.
Did most of the fellows who worked in the paper mill, before your time, I guess, did they go to school as well? Were they educated? Could they read and write? Or were they...
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of them were journeymen.
They left school at about 11 or 12 years old, but it was
basic education.
Yeah, reading, writing, and arithmetic. It was all church schools, you see, and they went to the church schools and the, they start about 4 or 5.
Yeah, just like normal.
When they could sort of read, write, and do arithmetic,
put them out to work in the farm.
They went to work sometimes 12. Sometimes my dad left at 13. I know when he left school, but then. I suppose it was 20s or the 30s, 14, the age of 14 came in.
So right.
Yeah.
Because that's what Harry was saying about being 14.
That's right, yeah. when, but that was, I suppose, you know, dates.
Around 1920,
yeah,
somewhere around
and
there.
And then it sort of edged up to, in the 50s, it was 40s and 50s,
yeah.
Down to 15, and then after that, 16.
What was it like living in those, in the bungalows, all those houses? Or they weren't called the bungalows, the terraces?
Yeah.
Did people sort of, were they were all papermakers, right? Did you all, was there much talk about papermaking, or was it more just social sort of, was it very social, or is it just like these living in these row houses now? Or was it more social?
Oh, it was much more social than it ever is now, you know. I mean, the back places were sort of a wash house and a toilet outside, and there was a tap outside, so everybody went out to get the water, you know, and Mrs. So-and-so's got her washing out early this morning, or her washing isn't out, you know, sort of thing. And
this is not thought of in socializing, people don't know how
but
to
I mean, when they when the papermakers came down to Tuffenbeck, I mean, they and to hang themselves, you know what I mean, there was a club room there, the club room. Well, they used to go there, the men used to go there.
At the mill?
No, it belonged to the mill. No, it was done on the quay.
Well, halfway between the pub and the
And there was a club room there, and there was a piano, and they used to have sing songs, and they used to have concerts. And something, now this was something that the estate people never
came on before.
No, or did anything, you know, they wouldn't join in until last day later. And then in the 20s, of course, they sort of got together and built the parish hall and the village hall, which they fell out. Then it was estate people against the Tuckney people, basically, the sort of little...
Tuckney
isn't it? All right. No, we noticed that. Well, it's part of Cornworthy.
Part of Ashbury.
Cornworthy.
The stream in the middle always was divided.
Oh, really? Between
Ashburton
and...
Yes, Ashburton and Tuckney. But I think now, through the parish changes, it isn't the dividing line anymore. I think it's all in Ashburton Parish or something weird, you know, but I'm not quite sure.
The old books listed it in Cornworthy.
Half of the mill was in Cornworthy, definitely.
Yeah.
But the other side of the little stream, that was Ashburton.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be hard in the old records to sort of track who was the papermakers living where, because you've got all these different places.
That's right, you see. And the Smiths and the Coxes, Grandfather Cox, they didn't live in the terrace, they lived in the other little terrace.
Up where Cyril lives now, is that?
No, you know, the other side of the stream, you know, come into, there's like a little terrace there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Isaac, he worked
we always
at the mill.
Ash Heap View.
And
Ash Heap View.
Yeah, it was the Grandfather Cox, he lived there. Sid Smith, he was another old papermaker, came down from Kent, he lived there. And another Cox on the end, Dog Cox, he lived there as well. So there was papermakers there on the other side. There was papermakers down the road, wasn't there?
The post office.
As you go down the road, there was some... Williams, he worked at the mill, Evans worked at the mill, and in the post office, the old Clyde Howard, he was the finisher, and his wife kept the post office, but he was the finisher at the mill, so there was many more papermakers, if you know what I mean, spread along the village, and just in the, it wasn't just the terrace, you see.
I see what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Finisher means he managed the finishing room? Or?
Yes, he supervised all the packing.
Yeah.
Used to set the glazing.
Supervised the men that worked. Some had to be rough, finished, and some had to be...
So he and was there any other managers in the mill? I guess Sammy would have been, the Eastons would have been the managers for the vat house and the beater room and all that, right?
Perth Easton was the big boss.
Right.
There was no doubt. He'd come and tell the finisher what to do.
Was there any other small bosses? There'd be the finisher. Was there any other, or is just only really the finishing room?
There was really only the... There was a foreman, yes, in charge of it, Jack Mann. He was in charge of the rag house. But they were all under the main...
Right.
Perth Easton was the big boss.
He was
a papermaker himself. And he could... If they said the work wasn't going right in the machine, you know, they couldn't make this... He would take the fat of the mold and do a sheet.
Just to see if they were right or if they were...
And he'd say, and if he couldn't do it, okay, the mixture was wrong.
Yeah.
But his son, Sam, could never do that.
Huh.
He was never, you know...
Didn't work a vat.
No, he couldn't work a vat. But, with drying, if they said, you know, things weren't drying right, you know, he'd got, you know, cause sometimes, with the machine, a sheet would roll, or it would roll up at the top, you know, and one cylinder would be too hot or
getting
something.
Too much curl or...
Curl, and then it would go under another one and of course, fold.
Yeah.
You see, and things like that coming out creased and all this, which was broken then. And if old Perth was there, he'd come along and he'd say, turn that down up there, or, you know...
He'd know
he,
it was...
The one previous a bit more, so that it, he'd know exactly what to do. He was a really skilled man.
And he was there when Milbourne was the owner?
He came to the mill with Milbourne.
I see.
When Milbourne took over, Perth Easton came with him. I mean, Milbourne was...
Did Milbourne know about papermaking?
He was a batman as well.
Oh, really? Milbourne was?
Yes. The old man, old Arthur Milbourne, was a papermaker. He got backed by somebody to take over the mill. I don't think he ever owned it in the beginning, you know.
How come he sold out to Harrison, you know?
Well, this was his son, you see. His son was never really a... papermaker.
Interested in it, yeah.
I mean, he was interested in the business side, you know,
yeah.
He ran the business, but he was never a papermaker as his father was.
So he sold the business, or did he go into bankruptcy, or did he?
Oh, no, he did very well. Okay. You see, during the war, there was, the stockroom was full.
Mm.
But during the war, when things were short than that, I think Arthur Milburn made quite a lot of money on
because he had a full stock room.
Because he had a full stock room, you see, it kept going through the war, but a lot of the workers were called up. Vaughan, Eaton, Kingston, well.
Must have been everybody gone. Cyril was gone.
Yeah.
Were they still working during the war?
Kept going, but you know, but as
they,
I say,
they said they would make paper of anything during the war and sell it. You know, they were even using apple sacks and that sort of thing.
Anything that couldn't get the foreign, French rags and things or any of those things.
Pretty bad quality paper during the war then that came out.
Well, I suppose so, but then again. He had the quality paper in the stockroom, you see. So there was, Spicers and Waterloos and all those people still wanted the legal paper, so it was still there, you see.
Yeah.
So I think he made quite a lot of money. And then after the war, you see, things became a bit more difficult, and then he sold out while the going was good.
Yeah.
And his son wasn't very interested. They put him at different mills around, but I don't think he had any interest.
Was Arthur Milburn alive when the mill was sold to Harrison?
No.
Not the old
man. No, the old man had died on
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Old Arthur Milburn, but his son Arthur.
His younger son was Arthur as well.
Yeah,
oh, that's
yeah.
The confusion, okay.
Yeah, yeah. There was two Arthur Milburns, the son and the younger son never went into the papermaking at all, really, the one that took over from him. His other son, Tommy Milburn, he was the true papermaker sort of thing, but he was killed he was gassed in the First World War, so he came home and died. Then his younger brother had to take over the business, you see, so that he wasn't a real papermaker, he was a businessman, you know, he'd been trained something different. So this is a sort of a family sort of tragedy that the papermaker had been killed.
Do you think the old Milburn family have any of the old records from their mill, or do you think they really kept nothing?
There isn't any left.
Well, Kitty seems to think there's a daughter, and Ron thought there was a son.
Oh, yes, Rosemary. Yes, I was thinking about that. But I've never heard of her.
Kitty seems to know where, maybe,
well,
she talked, she said she wrote to her a couple of years ago or something.
Oh, yeah. I somehow doubt it. But
you do, yeah.
Yeah, I doubt it.
The stuff that we've turned out of the mill, I mean, even the old man's income tax returns and that were there. So I would have thought, you know, most of what the...
Everything was left with the mill?
I think so.
Yeah. You remember burning all those sorts of things at the end?
Yes, ton of income tax returns and...
God, that's terrible from an archivist's point of view.
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, the stuff he burned, he stood over, so he had to.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah,
yeah.
I did keep
what
a lot of stuff, but
what
I got rid of it since.
I mean, officially, should have been burned.
Right. Well, we've heard from a lot of different people as we've been talking that lots of things did sort of slide out that should have been burned. Some of the guys over at Ivy Bridge, they ended up with molds that they said that sort of came in the boot of their car.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you've seen Ivor Earn.
Ivan, yeah. Well, no, we didn't meet Ivan. No, what was the other fellow? Dennis? No. The guy who was the chief chemist.
No, I don't know him.
Douglas,
yeah.
No, I don't
know. Anyway, he got one from Ivan, yeah.
I got it from Ivor.
Do you remember where those got sold to? I mean, he said they were probably sold with the machine when the mold machine got sold or something. But anyway, so there are some molds for sale are not for sale, but available.
When the mill was closing down, a lot of people came around. One of them was Harrison, let quite a few people have a pair of molds, for a few pounds. But he wouldn't, all the watermarks had to be cut off before.
Oh,
he wouldn't let them have any of the watermarks on. Because some people offered to pay them, quite exorbitant sums for
one really beautiful watermark. Yeah.
I mean, something like this would have gone mad about it. But if he didn't, that watermark would have been scraped off.
If you hadn't stuck that one out.
I stuck it out of the way.
I was saying, what did your father do in the mill?
He was a labourer in the mill. He worked in the beater house.
There was...
And then, latterly, as he got older, he worked at the rolls.
The glazing rolls?
Mm-hmm.
In the beater room, like loading rags into the beater and moving them around?
Yeah, with his brother-in-law, who was the Coxes.
The Coxes were working the beaters, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Sam's father was...
The beater man to start with when Milburn took over, and then Sam... And his brother Len were the two
Petermen
there.
I guess it was Len and then Sam.
Yeah. But nobody.
So do you have children?
Yeah.
But they're not interested in papermaking?
No, they finished,
Yeah.
No, they were. boy, well, the mill was more or less closed, like, you know, as a paper mill. You know?
Yeah.
When you got married, did you live in Tuckenhay then?
Yep.
Yes. Well, I was in the Army, and I joined the Army in 1934.
Well, the Milburn's cottage is down by the water.
Well, you were in the Army a long time then.
Oh, okay.
And
12 years.
Then, after the war, we...
In the service, were you living, traveling?
No,
oh, you were staying here?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And then the little bungalow up by the mill chimney, up over the top of the mill. Did you notice
this?
No, we were at Cyril's house. It must be...
Well, up above...
Above that.
Mm-hmm. The wood at the back, up on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived there for 25 years. We sold up from there. Half a year ago. So
mm-hmm.
we lived in Tuckenhay all the while until 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Did they point out the mill chimney? Did
you? Yeah, they did, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they take the top off it now. It was... What's the way it is? Now it's
mm-hmm.
the stonework.
They took all the sort of
the tunnel right through the wood.
Through the wood to make sure there was no sort of dust or soot in the valley to get in the paper.
Well, that's what I remember. Cyril walked me along there to show me it went miles and miles up.
I used to go up the tunnel every year and inspect it.
You mean crawl through it?
Yeah.
Well, like Santa Claus or something?
It's only a case of walking your head down.
Oh,
it's quite big enough.
Uh-huh. We used to take a rope from the top, run it right down through, and tie a holly bush on the end and pull it down through.
To clean it out?
Just to clean it a bit.
Did they ever get flue fires in that thing?
And?
Did you ever have fires in it?
No.
They were cleaned
when there's
once a year.
There's soot extractors at the bottom we used to take. We used to take out about 6 to 8 tons of soot
every year. They cleaned the flue.
Give it to the local
farm. All the labourers, and when the mill was closed, in August, they went in and cleaned the flue, all the stuff out, all the crap.
Mm. Just go inside the boilers and chip the rock out.
Yes, and then some maintenance, like the fire for that.
They decarbonised the gas engine. There was a Ruston Hornsby producer gas engine there when I went there.
That's right.
130 horsepower.
The wheel told us about it.
Single cylinder.
Heated the water for the steam.
130 horsepower at 180 revs a minute.
They went in and chipped all the lime off in the chisels and hammers. I know.
Get the lime out of the inside of the boiler.
Yes, the two boilers and
the latter. You were treating it with Ultraloc and throwing it and getting rid of it. Chemically.
Was there a lot of problem with dirt in the mill, or was it a pretty clean mill, getting in the vats and things like that?
You had a lot of trouble making sure it didn't get in. It used to occasionally get there, but that's the idea of the chimney on top of the hill, but we're not certain about it.
You know, a tiny speck of metal
mm-hmm.
or something, you know, and then, you know, the wet paper, the iron mold
right.
would go through the
a whole
you
big
know.
Pack to get a brown
yeah,
skin
yeah,
right on
right.
through it.
And that was broken, you see.
Beautiful
that
illustration of that here.
Hinges
on yeah. that. Yeah, yeah. You see, yeah.
Really ruined a nice piece of handmade, doesn't
yeah.
it?
But this was the point. It was when it was sorted, you see. They had a dozen different...
Do you make any like that there?
There was best paper, you know, and then retree, and there were several sorts of retree, and
Imperial Forum did.
It was really a whole range of stuff that...
There's one sheet on there.
The dirt was... The thing, you see, dirt was the real enemy of paper.
Yeah.
You know, I mean... No matter, just a speck of sort of soot wasn't too bad, because that would ruin two sheets.
Mm-hmm.
But metal would...
Virtually indestructible.
Would go through a pack, you know, perhaps a dozen sheets, you know. Yeah.
Reasons why Tuckenhay Mill closed down was that
same as paper, it was through not being able to sell paper, but one of the things, little Harrison insisted on too high a standard.
Hmm.
You know, we're just looking.
Yes, we had a lot of.
You know, you see the Couture's drops and that.
Yeah.
Well, nothing like that had to pass. Uh-huh. He would have no.
Honestly, you had a whole lot of Retrie and Brook going back in the theater.
And Basildon Bond buying Retrie off him, you know, at a cheap rate, buying it. Everything he had in the way of Retrie. Well, they don't sell any second-class paper, do they? They're obviously a racket.
They were using it as first-class paper,
yeah,
huh?
And he wouldn't believe it.
Wouldn't they
say,
no, anything, you know?
Really speaking, the people who use paper don't put it up like
no,
that.
No, no one does.
In
fact,
there was a man who started making... What's he called?
Irishman, isn't he?
Yeah.
On the
Moors. Oh, yeah, okay. You know, Casey, is that?
Casey, that's the chap.
I mean, he used to deliberately put a spot in because he reckoned that was the hallmark of...
Did you meet that fellow?
I had a good laugh one day at him and Harrison talking together. And he'd come there, and he actually bought a beater and then didn't have it. But he came to the remover talking quite a bit, and he said... And Harrison said, now what you've got to do, you know, he was always telling him, you've got to make a perfect sheet, you know. No, you know, Casey said, Mr. Harrison, if we make a sheet with no faults in, we put a fault in. And Harrison nearly kicked him out of the middle. He wouldn't have more to do.
This
man's a fool, he said, he's a fool.
This Mr. O'Casey's got... He leaves a trail of stories about him behind him.
Yeah.
He seems to be quite a swindler.
I don't know if he was, but he sort of tickled us.
Because he had quite a few golds from Tuckley Mill.
Oh, yeah?
Sam's watermark.
He said, you had to put a... This was the trademark of a handmade sheet.
He said, this is a trademark.
Of course,
Harrison didn't believe that. He said, it's got to be perfect.
Did he live down here for a while, that O'Casey fellow?
No,
was visiting.
He was up on the moor, wasn't he?
Yeah, we had a place up on the moor, a hound store or sheep store.
Right, there's
store.
Tim Powell out there.
What?
There's a guy named Tim Powell, sheep store paper mill.
Oh, well, this is where O'Casey was.
Yeah, they were partners.
That's right,
yes.
Like
he left. He got in a lot of debt and then left them all to the
baby.
Yeah,
you're right, yeah.
Yeah.
As I say, a trail of things like that behind him.
You gave him, Sam Aston's colour book or something, wasn't it?
Handwritten,
you know, colour books.
He
took that out. Talked that out.
Yeah, he said was going to take it away and have it photographed and all this sort of thing, and he would bring it back. We never saw him again.
Well, I said he's got stories like that trailing behind him.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sam's personal book, that was, you know, he wrote about everything down that he'd done in there.
Yeah.
And a lot of things he didn't do as well. But
the proportions of colour that he...
Of course, that's supposed to be in that book, isn't it? All the
proportions. Well, it's sort of in here, isn't it?
It should be in there, the colour of the raglan.
Yeah. It's just a little hard to figure out.
Does it give the beading times and all that should do? It should give the beading times. I don't suppose Sam kept
rags. No, it doesn't really say how long.
Well, this really depended on the beaterman.
Yeah, I think
this was his skill. I mean, he knew what was sort of, how do I put it, what type of paper, was to be made, and this was the
fisherman's
skill.
It says if it's a big beater or a small beater.
Yeah.
What?
This says if they use a small beater or a big beater.
Yeah, well, it was only two sides, only one big beater.
How big was the big one? How big was the small one?
The small one's 180 pounder, and the big one was 240 pounder. Mm-hmm. That's dry rig to, not a quarter of water, I think 200 gallons in the small one. Quarter than a large one, if I remember rightly, but...
I mean, the time it went out of the beater down...
Yeah, well, they used to test it, and it was a couple of dippers out of water,
so they
get the right length.
This was the skill of it.
Because you could never get in, and a lot of people said that the beater didn't really cut it down. It wasn't sharp as a beater. It, It's full of bracing, isn't it? Not
pull
it,
beating. Pull it, really, it, yeah,
beat,
yeah.
Beat it, pull it to the.
You see, if they did it too quickly, they'd ruin. You know, somebody will
When you used a paper machine, like the cylinder mold machine, it had to be gone off quickly, or it was too wet. It wouldn't come off on the, you know, the, was it the couch roll, innit? I'm getting mixed up with the dandy roll.
Right.
Couch roll.
Yeah.
The couch roll, and picking up, it's quite a sharp pickup. And if the pulp was too wet, it would fall off under the mold.
So I guess they must have really mattered how good the beater man was. I mean, we've always heard
well,
that.
Well, it did, really, yes.
Well, this was the real...
We always used to say the beater man made the paper. The paper maker really shook it together.
You know, the paper was a failure, if you know.
But you didn't have any bad beater men there, I hope.
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, sometimes the...
Well, Sam used to interfere with him, and I used to call him a
bug. Yeah, Sam Mason would come and interfere, and then...
But he knew, like, what he didn't mean.
Oh, that would the Peterman would really complain there.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. Oh, Sam Cox. He had a stutter when he was...
the upset.
That
there.
Yeah.
Couldn't get it
out. Couldn't get it out. He'd sort of walk away and come back and then swear. And he'd be all right. He said a few swear words, you know. Call him a, you know...
Right,
something or other, you know, and... Then he could say what he wanted to say.
I said we always told him that the paper was made in the beater room. It was only shook together by the paper makers.
Yeah.
They didn't make it.
That's stop you taking a second day.
So they were telling us about singing in the bat room. Well, they didn't actually call it singing, they said just yelling.
Yeah, well, it was such a racket there with knotters going, they couldn't hear themselves speaking.
Did they ever sing in the older days? Did your was there a choir of?
I don't think so. Football, and they had a cricket team once. And I think there was
the last time the cricket team played it.
They had pantomimes there.
They were all.
And in Harrison's time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Done by the paper makers?
Yeah, the village people, you know.
And what's a pantomime in English? I'm not sure if I'm translating proper into American.
Concert.
Well, basically, you don't know pantomimes.
I'm not sure.
Stories.
Done with puppets or just told?
No, people.
Dressed in costume.
Yeah, there's Dick Whittington, there's Cinderella.
Mm.
All these old stories that are done in pantomime with singing and dancing and chatting, you know, and Aladdin.
I think I know what you mean,
these merry men.
Right.
Yeah. Choose of,
kind of like doing musicals now, how they do
this,
it. Yeah.
This is the thing, but it's the old stories, if you know what I mean.
Right.
They're tradition more than, I mean, a musical can be modern or anything.
Yeah, it's sort of modern.
But Christmas... we always have pantomimes. I mean, there's the local ones, and there's the ones in the theatres. There's pantomimes.
Mm.
What about dancing? Any dancing?
Or is that not considered proper?
Folk dancing?
At chorus. In the pantomimes. But you really dance... Oh, yes, at the village hall, there was a village hop, you know, a sixpenny hop, where there was the postmistress played the piano, one of the paper makers,
violin.
Mm. And the village baker was the drummer, and...
my mother used to play the mandolin.
That's right, and his father was the violin sometimes, you know.
But they used to have dances in the old barn, didn't they?
Yeah, before the village hall was built, this was something that the paper makers brought, the estate people.
How often would they do dances?
Once a month or twice a month, depending, you know. This is how they raised the money to build the village hall and that, but with these sixpenny dances.
Oh, it cost a sixpenny to get in, and that would go towards.
Yeah, and they'd serve, you know, tea and coffee and refreshments, which I had to pay for, you see, which all this money was raised.
Hmm. Was there any Morris dancers back in those days, or is that mostly new stuff?
There was, but not locally.
Mm.
At Dartington, they always had a team of Morris dancers, as long as I can remember.
But nothing down in Tucker.
But that was always considered, fairies.
Yeah.
The local called the Morris dancers sort of fairies. It was, but sort of rudest thing I could think about.
Sort of like sissies or something
that's
like that.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, do say sissies, they call them fairies, you see. But it didn't deter them at all. I mean, they were mostly big men who could take care of themselves.
Right.
They didn't call them fairies to their face, sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Very big party in those days. Everybody went to church once a day, you know. I mean, kids unluckily went to church in the morning and Sunday school in the afternoon and church in the evening, like,
on,
you know,
Sunday all day.
On,
huh?
Sunday, yes, this was your thing. And I mean, our Granny Cox, didn't like to admit. You could read, but was supposed to read the sort of Bible or something, you know, and not novels or anything, you know, and you weren't playing cards was the, you know, absolute sort of out on a Sunday, wasn't it, Tom?
Did a lot of the ladies in Tucker knit?
Yes, they knit, did all this sort of thing. Well, I mean, basically, you are either or else you did. We weren't well dressed because the money wasn't. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This was it. I mean, his mother was a marvelous leader woman. I mean, she'd make trousers and suits for men and everything. You know, there was no doubt.
The old singer from the machine.
Did people go out? Did they stay in Tucker most of the time, or were they always going off to Ashburton and Totnes and stuff? Or did people sort of stay in the hamlet
think,
couple times?
The three villages, you know, they some people from Tucker went to Cornworthy Church. Some people went to Ashburton Church, you see, or some people went to the same Ashburton people came down to the chapel down at Tucker Hay, you see. The three villages sort of, though they had vicars in those days, they were sort of interlinked in a lot of ways, the two villages, with Tucker Hay sort of in the centre, you know.
Did you have a baker in Tuckenay at the time?
Yeah. At one time, yeah. Well, then that finished. And there was a baker at Ashburton and one at Cornworthy.
Yeah.
And they delivered in a horse and pony trap. That's where they went. The butcher was at Bowbridge.
It was a real traveling man in those days.
There was a butcher there, but there was a butcher came from Black Horton and a baker came from Halberton Ford, and a butcher went to Halberton Ford, and there was a tinker came from there was a bus service started.
Once the bus services started, Do you remember before the bus services started many of the traveling, the tramping paper makers coming through? Was that quite an event? Would they be sort of like bring news from places? Or were they sort of, did people want to get rid of them? Were they welcomed or were they not welcomed usually?
Journeyman.
Yeah, really, no idea.
You can't remember anything about it.
I can't remember that. I remember them coming and lodging with papermakers in the village, you mm-hmm. know. Certain ones, you know, Harry Loveland, where he only, him and his wife, well, they had spare rooms in their house. So they would take in, you know, these lads that came, but I really can't remember much about them.
At the pub?
It really thinned out a lot after the 1418 war,
yeah.
didn't it?
But they did come a bit, you know, there, and I remember them coming to stay in the terrace. The Lovelands had one of the terraces, number 7, I think. They lived there for years and years, you know, and they used to take in, you know, lads and that that came. But,
you know, I've got a vague memory of all these, you know, distant clouds, as I might say, of Australian soldiers coming in with Waterman's arms, and that must have been 1918. I must have been about 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, was a slouch act for
this side.
The Australians.
Most of those fellows stopped marching. The traveling paper, the what were they called? The Cart of Freedom. They didn't travel so much. There weren't so many of them, I guess. Yeah.
No. They weren't prepared, anyway, to travel, were they? You know, I mean, how do I put it? They were educated.
Yeah, they didn't, yeah.
And they didn't consider it necessary, you know. They could sort of...
get a different job if they wanted
to. Yeah. This was the point. I don't think they would tolerate this sort of thing anymore.
Yeah. It's things are different. Like when I was a youngster, people would walk from Cornwall to Totnes to do a bit of shopping and walk back again.
Yeah, we were wondering about that.
But,
yeah.
I mean, they would walk it now. Considered.
We were wondering how long it took to walk from Tuckney to Totnes or from Cornwall to Totnes.
Well, it took good, well over half an hour, you know, for young people. The only person that used to do it quicker was Sam Clark. And he used to jog.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He'd do it in about 20 minutes, but Sam would run. I mean, he was a fit man, you know, and he'd sort of jog in Totnes and, you know. But that was the only one I ever knew that do it like that.
I was thinking now it'd take a lot longer because you'd always be dodging cars. You couldn't go very fast.
In those days, yeah.
You met Orson Trapp, it was an occasion.
Yeah.
No, but when the mill... going back to after the 1418 war, there was women used to work in the rag house at Tuckney Mill. It came from Dittisham. I don't know if you know where that is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they used to walk to the mill, start at 6 o'clock in the morning and finish 6 in the evening and walk home again, and they didn't think nothing of it. You know.
Yeah.
In fact, there used to be a laugh. They said they always know whether they've fallen out during the day or not, because if they've fallen out, they'd be, you know, walking single file in front of each other. But if everything's happy, they'd be all walking together in a crowd, like every 3 or 4
of them. Well, people used to walk from Hubbard and Ford to work at the mill as well, you know. I mean, that's quite a step.
Yeah. So the people that worked in Tuckney, when there was over 100 people working there, they lived in all the villages, or the hamlets around.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Of course, just before the mill shut, it was 90 up there and then, but some of them came from Dartmouth and that, but they used to run a lorry around and pick them up.
Oh.
There was service where people used to go around all the villages and pick them up. Take them home again.
Because there wasn't quite enough people left in the Tuckney to work to fill up the mill.
No.
You see, they were working a 3-shift all the time. Then it was three lots. So it was 80. Well, it was 80 in and 80 out and 80 in, 80 out 3 times a day. Like, you know, that's a fair number for
hamlets like that.
Did they work around the clock at the mill then?
Yeah, when they were on the pulp, was this after the paper was making stuff.
But there wasn't so many people employed then, was there?
No.
There.
Well, there wasn't much in it, was there? Because there was, there was 80, I think 87 when it closed down.
Well, that's a lot of employees, isn't it?
You see, when they was making paper, 3 tons of paper a week was a good output. But when they did pulp, I mean, it was turning out 60 tons a week.
It's a lot of rags to go through.
A lot of rags and a lot of, you know, I know that it's not so much labor intensive, really. There's more machinery in it, but there's a lot of handling just the same.
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff had to be sorted and cut and all that sort of thing just the same. And we put an extra rag cutter in.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of one boiler, we had three. In fact, we had the fourth one going in the last 6 months. And, instead of bleaching in the beaters, we had bleaching tar. You don't find anything. I put the chaps coming about the clock in the row, and the last time I took the pieces, I took the number of teeth in each wheel, and the gear ratio was right through, and wrote it all to me. I said, well, let him have that, he'll know all he wants about it, and I can't find it.
Oh no.
I put it somewhere so safe that
right.
It's no longer available.
No.
People seem to have got a discontented show. and it seemed to come into this country quite a bit. The workers tend to say, why should we work for the boss to get the money? And they don't realize that the boss has got to get the money to pay them or something.
Yeah.
This is where the trouble runs right down the line, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We're at the end of it. People cared much about it.
Didn't seem to be a lot of mourning.
Well, I don't know. A lot of it people regret it. I'm sure older.
There was a lot of people coming to live in the village by then who don't really want industry there.
Right, they'd rather have
See, as soon as ever the mill closed and sold off the houses, that was really the end of
the
now I go there on Kitty Searle and a couple of others. Old Walter, did you meet old Walter?
No.
He was one of the old papermakers.
Is he there still?
Yeah. Well, I think so.
Cheryl didn't say anything about, or Kitty didn't say anything about him. Do you think they don't talk or something?
Oh, it's possible. He's a weirdie.
He wouldn't get anything out of him. He's practically dumb until he gets a drink or two, and then you can't stop him talking.
He was a papermaker all his life. His father came from Wales and settled there, and he was an apprentice to the dad, and he missed the first world war. He wasn't old enough for the first world war, and he was too old for the second, so Walter was sort of one of the, went right through the...
He kept working there?
Yeah, through the war, yeah.
Was he working there when it closed?
No.
I think he retired then.
He retired
just before.
Yeah,
he retired
then.
But I don't think he's worked anywhere else. He worked all his
life. No, his sister married another papermaker, Jack Lynn, who passed on life. So they were sort of original sort of papermakers. The Lynn family, there was Jack Lynn, George Lynn, wasn't it? Fred Lynn. That was three brothers all working in the I don't know. And then their son, George Lynn's son Jack, worked as a lad with Cyril, like as a paper-maker.
He became a bookmaker, so he sort of... Well, we heard about him.
Yeah, that's right. He became
Ron told us about something. He went off and became a bookmaker.
That's right, yes.
That's Jack.
But, you know, they were all, the family were all in the sort of mill, you know.
Yeah.
It was very family things, you know, fathers, you know, sons, followed fathers and that sort of thing. Another one was Horace Chalcraft. He lived along there. He was foreman for a little while until he became ill, and then Cyril took over the job. His sons worked, you know, but neither of them were paper makers.
No, one was a chippy.
They worked with Tom. One was a chippy and one was the engineer, like, so. Neither of them sort of were paper makers. You know.
Chippy because he worked with wood?
Yeah.
And carpenter, yeah.
Yeah.
Fell in the army. No, you don't understand Italian either, right?
No, I didn't. So would he keep the molds? Would you guys keep the molds in shape?
Oh, you used to do a bit of...
When the brass breaks and all that? I used to do
most of that, actually. He was more of a... cabinet maker, or either repairer of the building, windows, roofs, and all that sort of thing. You know.
He worked more in the machinery bits, like
yeah.
That.
He would spend hours
sometimes repairing molds, which was a fiddly job.
Make the letters on the sewn on.
How do you ever keep the wire from breaking? Because whenever we've tried to sew with brass wires, it seems like it's always...
cockles and break.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you mustn't let it cockle.
That's the whole trick, it's just not to let it cockle.
If you put it through, you put your thumb in it, up here, and pull it down like that, you know, keep it straight all the time, right down it.
Did you use a straight needle or a curved needle?
Straight, mostly. Go through and back again. Like.
You do it with a needle, too,
right? Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, you can do it. Some people say you can do it with a wire, but... you've got to go under a magnifying glass, and no matter what your eyesight's like, you know, I know I'd have to have a magnifying glass all the time, I think.
Did you back then use the magnifying glass, or could you see well enough?
No, I used to go without a magnifying glass, usually most of them. But when you're a lot of it recently has been soldered on, hasn't it?
Yeah, I've seen that.
The machine added the watermarks on the molds or around the drum, and they were nearly all soldered on.
Watermarks on yours?
Yeah, we have a very simple watermark on ours. It's just the town's name, Santa Cruz. It shows in that little buckle.
Where is Santa Cruz, please?
Near San Francisco.
In California.
Yeah.
See if I can see it. And Donna did the wire work. I just got to do a bit of this. Anyway.
It's fine that a page was...
there you go. Well, here's one watermark.
Did you ever make an embossed watermark?
Well, only where we had the dies. You know, you had a set of dies and put it underneath, and just very easy to do that because you just put on
before you
together.
No problem. Huh?
Yeah.
Before you sew it on,
because there's all these drainage holes, and that had to be right, didn't they, all along the edges.
Did it make a difference how they were set, the drainage holes?
Well, actually, if you going to use a thick coat on it, you've got to have the drainage holes as close together as possible. Like this was made for a pretty thick pulp.
These holes wanted to be bigger if it was for thicker sorts? Or?
Well, if you have them too big, it will upset the edge of your deco edge. So,
If they're too big, they'll upset your decalage. Yeah, that makes sense, because they'd be draining too fast.
Yeah, that's right. And they make little channels, you know. The decalage becomes even. And then, of course, the one thing you don't want is even decalage.
So what are you saying stops it from being even? What helps it to not be even?
If the holes are too big,
yeah,
the water will run out and leave even marks at each hole. Like, you know, you've got a sort of serrated edge. And,
this is a beautiful watermark. Yeah. I'll have to get a photograph of that.
It's
quite a lot of work cutting these little guys out.
Yes. Of course, this really, the real mold should have a real deckle. Should be flat along there and a slip on there.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Box slip.
The thing that they call the backing strip or whatever?
Yeah, the box strip, the strip to guide it when it hits.
Yeah.
Of course, they whack them on. In fact, Jeff Perrin, one of the blokes, I used to swear at him, he always used to wear the corner rolled out because he always, when he put the decal on here, he'd go clack, clack each time. It used to break the corner of the mold eventually.
So when these little things peel off, how do you get them back on again? Well, bigger nails?
They're tacked on.
Do you use bigger tacks or when they pull out? Or?
Sometimes they put them right through and turn them back
turn
inside.
Them over.
Like,
yeah, that's a trick, isn't it?
Yeah, because they tend to split if you're not careful. Of course, it is mahogany, should be.
How big a sheet do you...
The normal size that I make this is about 17 by 22 inches.
What's that cap?
Imperial.
The size is going up.
Yeah,
the smallest size was...
Cap.
Uh-huh.
And then double cap, which is...
Does it have two sheets on the mold?
Yeah. And then...
there
was Jamar.
That would be pretty, wouldn't
and
it?
And then medium.
Yeah.
What was the next one on? Royal?
I never...
That little booklet.
Other than...
Yeah.
Other
Royal
than, pulling... Making
right.
fun of them, I never read too
much. I never looked much, huh?
No.
What they were.
Imperial?
Elephant was bigger, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got
Imperial, Royal, Medium, Double False Cat.
Now, that's the real master.
What's the split up?
Well, that was where...
For note paper.
There's a heavy wire put in.
Oh, all right.
And after the sheet's made, you can tear it
on the
marking wire.
That was for...
Right.
Envelopes.
Note paper. But through being torn... You had the sort of rough edge, like the metal edge.
Right.
If it was
there's
cut,
one split
you see,
up here somewhere.
You've got a smooth.
Joyce was telling us about that. She said it was awful. She let on to Mr. Harris that she could split them, and all of a sudden she was splitting paper forever.
That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah, it was, I mean...
Did they have about a dozen sheets
and folds, you know, and then tear. And that gives the edge, you know.